So when I was thinking about the talk, the title of a book by Steve Worland, who's a poet in our department who died about a year ago, crossed my mind. The talk has nothing to do with Steve, but I like the title. The title of the book is This Particular Eternity, and every time I pass that on the wall, I think, what an amazing title. So what I'm trying to talk about is a particular sense of eternity that I don't think it's peculiar to Zen, but it's a little bit unusual or unexpected, and it seems important to me as a part of Zen practice, and I think it really has implications for how we practice and how we sit. I'm going to take a fairly long time, and I apologize for this in advance, talking about some fairly actually quoting a couple of long things that are fairly abstract and have nothing directly to do with Zen, and then I'm going to try and bring it around. So if that's as far as we get today, please come back another time, because we'll actually talk about the Zen part. So the first one is a quotation that I've read a few times, and another apology would be, this is David Bohm, Causality and Chance in Modern Physics, and I know Joan knows his work really well. I know only what I'm going to read here. It's the epigraph to a book that I love by another recently deceased poet, Leslie Scalapino, from one of her books. So we've talked about this before, and I think she was really close to Norman Fisher and Philip Whalen, and a very deep Zen practice, and I think she quotes this because it resonates for her with Zen, though it's about physics. So here's David Bohm. So I'm trying to say this is kind of some version of our sense of the world, and has something to do with emptiness as we talk about it. Nature may have in it an infinity of different kinds of things. In terms of the notion of the qualitative infinity of nature, one is led to the conclusion that every entity, however fundamental it may seem, this could be the Diamond Sutra right here, is dependent for its existence on the maintenance of appropriate conditions in its infinite background and substructure. This interconnection can, under appropriate conditions, grow so strong that it brings about qualitative changes in the modes of being of every kind of entity known thus far through that infinite interrelation of things. This type of interconnection we shall denote by the name of reciprocal relationship, to distinguish it from mere interaction. And again, just to sort of plant something that seems very far away from Frank Sinatra singing, I did it my way, you know, or I gotta be me. So in this process, there is no limit to the new kinds of things that can come into being, and no limit to the number of kinds of transformations, both qualitative and quantitative, that can occur. But if all things eventually undergo qualitative transformations, then the process described above will never end. Thus we conclude that the notion that all things can become other kinds of things implies that a complete and eternally applicable definition of any given thing, like what's the essence of X, is not possible in terms of any finite number of qualities and properties. Thus we see that because every kind of thing is defined only through an inexhaustible set of qualities, each having a certain degree of relative autonomy, so only relative autonomy, nothing in the thing is completely autonomous, such a thing can and indeed must be unique, i.e. not completely identical with any other thing in the universe, however similar the two things may be, since each one is differently placed and has a different infinite set of reciprocal relations with everything else. Carrying the analysis further, we now note that because all of the infinity of factors determining what any given thing is are always changing with time, no such a thing can even remain identical with itself as time passes. That's a really abstract formulation of it, but it seems to me it's very close to a sense of the world that Buddhism often articulates. So I want to play that off. This is a really demoniac passage. This is from it's long and it's hard, and I apologize, but let me try and plant something to make it more palatable. So this is from Jacques Derrida, who's definitely not a Buddhist, though in a funny way he's very religious and is the grandson of North African rabbis and so on. But it's a very famous early essay called Structure, Sign, and Play in the Human Sciences. And what Derrida, being a philosopher, is kind of talking about the history of Western metaphysics and how things work there. I think he's trying to sort of work his way out of that perspective and towards something that's actually very like the Bohm quotation that I just read. So he talks about a certain kind of break that he doesn't really go on to define, but it's in light of that different way of looking at things that he's kind of outside this tradition that in some sense he's dismantling. And I also want to say, I guess, just a couple other things before I read this, that what I remember from the 60s was that there was a really sort of glib notion of quote-unquote dualistic thinking, as if it were just a bad thing that only bad, dead Western males did, and if you just got a little bit hip, it would be really easy to completely, you know, depart from it. So I do think that there is, you know, there's a kind of investment in the validity of categorical thinking sometimes in the West that may be a little different from what happens other places in the world. But if you study linguistics and so on, the notion of sort of binaries and dualism is very deep in human thinking. So what I want to suggest is that in some way we're interested in sort of crawling beyond the same thing Derrida is interested in crawling beyond here. At the same time, it's certainly no easy fix. You know, you sort of get a little beyond, you fall back into it, and so on. The other thing I want to say is that this will be, you know, pretty abstract, but about toward the middle, he starts talking about, oh, how this way of thinking that's different from the Bohm can kind of alleviate anxieties. And for me, if I sort of float with this a little bit, it's very, very close to sort of things that come up while you're sitting, things that you want to hold on to, things that you don't want to let go of. And in fact, what he's pushing against is in some sense very much, it seems to me, what we have to push against in sitting, or what he's trying to let go of is very much like what we have to try to let go of, right? And so also to plant a little bit, I mean, he's going to talk about sort of great Western ideas, but if you think, what's my investment in a self, or what's my investment in myself, what's my investment in the notion that through Zen practice I will find some incredible sort of eternity or stillness that maybe will be, we think, the opposite of where we are now, or here we are now and everything is kind of mired and compromised, but someplace else. I don't know how often we have thoughts like this, but I think even if we think we don't have them, we have them a lot. You know, there's going to be this sort of purity that will be completely stable and outside what he's going to call the free play of things going on. And the first time I read this, when I heard free play, I taught elementary school for a while, so I wouldn't be drafted. And so I thought it was an odd sort of preschool metaphor that was so sort of namby-pamby. I think it has to do with sort of engineering and the sort of free play in a system, and it's probably a bad translation of something else from the French. Anyway, here's the long passage, right? Nevertheless, up until the event which I wish to mark and mark out and define, that's that break that's like Bohm, structure, or rather the structurality of structure. I should stop there. Okay, so one of the things in the Bohm is to suggest that any entity that's there, rather than being the sort of Frank Sinatra, I did it my way and I gotta be me and I'm eternally me, that any element in the universe is a function of this gigantic structure of interrelations and so on. And so what Derrida is saying that is in the history of the West and Western thought, we get very nervous about the notion that everything is the product of a structure, and so we want to brush that aside. Anyway, nevertheless, up until the event which I wish to mark out and define, structure, or rather the structurality of structure, and I think it sounds better in the French too, although it has always been involved, has always been neutralized or reduced, that one doesn't want to think the way Bohm does, and this by a process of giving it a center or referring it to a point of presence, a fixed origin. The function of this center is not only to orient, balance, and organize the structure, one cannot in fact conceive of an unorganized structure, but above all to make sure that the organizing principle of the structure would limit what we might call the free play of the structure. So as he'll say later, that is to sort of stabilize something by putting something out of play, not at risk, not in the game. No doubt that by orienting and organizing the coherence of the system, the center of a structure permits the free play of its elements inside the total form, and even today the notion of a structure lacking any center represents the unthinkable itself. Nevertheless, the center also closes off the free play it opens up and makes possible. So there are moments maybe when you're sitting where everything's getting incredibly wobbly, and in some sense you might say, oh, here's this fixed thing I'm going to hang on to. This isn't wobbly. It makes you less nervous maybe. All right. Qua center, it is the point at which the substitution of contents, elements, or terms is no longer possible. At the center, the permutation or the transformation of elements is forbidden. At least this permutation has always remained interdicted. Thus, it has always been thought that the center, which is by definition unique, constituted that very thing within a structure which governs the structure while escaping structurality. So God would be one name for that, right? So everything else can be a variation of everything else, but everything is fine in my thought because here's the origin in God, or here's the origin in eternity, or here's the origin as myself in the world I know. This is why classical thought concerning structure could say that the center is paradoxically within the structure and outside it. So it's sort of governing it from on high in some way. The center is at the center of the totality, and yet since the center does not belong to the totality, is not part of the totality has its center elsewhere. The center is not the center. Thus, the concept of centered structure, although it represents coherence itself, is contradictorily coherent. So he's trying to push it around a little bit. And as always, coherence and contradiction expresses the force of a desire. So what he's saying is that we have a deep desire to have something be guaranteed, fixed, stable, not put in play, not thrown into the ring, not a function of everything else and always changing and not even self-identical. The concept of centered structure is in fact the concept of a free play based on a fundamental ground, a free play which is constituted upon a fundamental immobility and a reassuring certitude, which is itself beyond the reach of the free play. And you could think you're sitting to reaffirm that or define that, or you could say in the moment where everything's getting shaky, I'm going to stay with what's stable because it's too scary to do the opposite. With this certainty, anxiety can be mastered, for anxiety is invariably the result of a certain mode of being implicated in the game, of being caught in the game, of being, as it were, from the very beginning, at stake in the game. And that's really important, I think. I don't know if that's resonating with people, but it's so hard when you're sitting there in a retreat, let's say, really in some sense, to throw yourself into the ring. You know, there you go, you just throw it in with everything else. And, you know, it's not a one-shot deal, but the self that's doing the thinking is no more fixed, no more out of play, no more guaranteed, no more likely to find some eternal place where it will be completely stable through meditation than anything else is. So it's really the opposite in some way of what we might think we came to practice for, though it turns out to fulfill the same thing, you know. All right. This reduction of the structurality of structure always attempts to conceive of structure on the basis of a full presence which is out of play, you know, not at risk. If this is so, the whole history of the concept of structure before the rupture I spoke of must be thought of as a series of substitutions of center for center as a linked chain of determinations of the center. Successively and in a regulated fashion, the center receives different forms or names. The history of metaphysics, like the history of the West, is the history of these metaphors and metonymies. So, I mean, some of that, if you think in the sort of grand terms that he's talking about, comes quickly to mind. So what's the center? Oh, God is the center. The moment of creation is the center. Eden is the center. The Word, you know, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. So Logos, the Word, is the center. Maybe eternity is the center. And all that stuff is what's out of play in our thinking, you know. And it's okay that certain things are in play because that's out of play. You know? It seems to me that in a more subtle and kind of sneaky and unthinking way, that all the time for all of us, there are things closer to home that are out of play. So, thing I've mentioned a few times, Freud says someplace, and partly he's trying to dismantle the same thing that Derrida is, and partly not, but he says that it's impossible to dream your own death. And then I told you also that I know people who've meditated for a long time who say, nonsense, I do it all the time. But I remember having one or two dreams where I couldn't, you know, I was about to dream that I died and I had to wake up. So there's this sense that the self can't be at risk, the self can't be at play. And even if we know we're going to die, you know, if you have a certain traditional religious sense, you say, oh, but the self survives. And even if you don't believe that, someplace in there it's like, oh, all the same, I really, you know, I claim not to believe it, but it's hard not to believe it, that the self is eternal, you know, that there's something that doesn't, is not in play and is not at risk. And I think partly the process of sitting is this process of letting go a little bit and then realizing that you've held on and so on. All right. What I want to suggest, and I don't think there's any surprise at this point, is that the practice we're involved in is a lot closer to the Bohm view of things than to the kind of metaphysical tradition that Derrida is also, like Bohm, kind of trying to dismantle. And one of the things I think that means, certainly as we practice, If you have some experience of an opening, the strange thing is that if, you know, we talk about, and Joan talks about it this way, you see a kind of shimmering eternal aspect, there's a kind of radiant stillness, there's this incredible silence, but exactly in those moments, it feels really inextricably intertwined with everything that's in motion, that's noisy, and all that, you know. So there's a sense that if there's something that satisfies in some way the same kind of longing that Derrida is talking about, there is this sense of stillness, there is this sense of silence, there is this sense of here's eternity right here, that weirdly enough, if you try to peel it off from all those things that are in play and are its opposite, it would evaporate, you would lose it. So that's in a way what I like about Steve's title of this particular eternity. The eternity is particular in the sense that it's the eternal aspect of this particular moment. And it's also particular, it seems to me, in that in many respects it's unlike the way most of us would think about eternity. So there's no sense that, oh, you find the eternal moment, or you find the eternal quality within the moment, that means there's a you that will live forever with that, or something like that. All right. So I want to read two things, and there's a koan that I wanted to get to, but I think I'll leave that for another talk. So here are two evocations, at least as I understand them, and we've heard one because it's by Joan, and we've read another because it's Suzuki Roshi, where it seems to me that there's an attempt to evoke a sense of that sort of stillness and brightness that makes vivid to us the extent to which it's part and parcel of everything that's in play, at risk, and in motion. Mm. All right. So this is Joan from 2009 talk at the Morningstar Retreat, and we were playing these talks over a period of a few weeks, maybe about a month or a month and a half ago. And the context here is that she's been talking about the enlightenment story of the Buddha, and one of the things that happens is before he sits down all night and has the awakening experience, he makes a vow that if a certain thing happens, not only will he not get up until he's awakened, but he will be awakened this very night. And what he does is, there's this rushing stream going by him, and he throws the bowl that Sujata has given him full of this milk that revives him and saves his life. He throws it into the stream, and he says, I vow that if the bowl floats upstream instead of downstream with the current, that I will be awakened this very night. And there are lots of different ways of interpreting that moment. The talk that Joan's been giving, that I'll be quoting from, she interprets it really as going out to meet, and not turning away from, but going out to meet this incredible sort of rushing and roiling sequence of events that is our life in the world. So exactly that sense of everything being a function of everything else, you know, of everything sort of rushing towards you, too fast to separate out, and so on. And what she's going to say in this passage, as I understand it anyway, is that exactly in meeting that stream of ceaseless event, that's exactly where the sort of stillness and brightness is, and it's that's coming towards you along with and inextricable from this kind of roiling quality. And there's also something in you, also inextricable from everything that's in play, that's coming to meet it. So here's the passage. And she's talking about an image from Linji. All right. Linji spoke in another place about the activity which cuts through the stream. And what he meant by that was what he called the marvelous activity, the activity of the marvelous, which is in that rushing and roaring, the almost overwhelming stream of life of which we are a part. There is a something. There are currents we can identify. There are patterns we can see. There is a kind of remarkable clarity that if we're willing to look, we can take hold of in some way. So that's the activity that cuts through the stream in the sense of something that isn't overthrown by the chaos and roiling of the onrushing of things, something that coheres and remains a single bright thing. And that's coming toward us too in the midst of all the chaos of the stream. And we can bring our own activity that cuts through the stream. We can go looking for that clarity, that radiance, that coherence, all in all of the apparent chaos and jumble of things. I think the trick here is that, and the koan I want to talk about, I guess next time I return to this, is about this too. I think it's the trick of thinking is it's almost impossible to get any articulation of that stillness, of that brightness, of that silence, of that eternal aspect, and not want to sort of bootleg it out of the realm where everything is in play. It's almost impossible not to say, well, that's the part I like, so let's separate that out and keep it, you know? And even if we think we're not doing that, we do it again and again. And one of the things I want to talk about in the next talk I give is that the Cohen tradition is partly an attempt to keep subverting that, you know, to take all the ways in which we can sort of say, oh, of course nothing's out of play, except this one thing that doesn't have any name, which is the no, and that's out of play, and to sort of throw that back into play for you. We won't get there today, but here's Suzuki, a passage that we talked about a couple times in our Tuesday night group. And again, it seems to me it's possible to say, oh, he's locating this eternal thing that's elsewhere, that's different from everything that's in flux, but I think that's not the implication. I think the implication is, again, that they're inextricably part of one another, and that you can't have one without the other. To live in the realm of Buddha nature means to die as a small being, moment after moment. When we lose our balance, we die, but at the same time, we also develop ourselves, we grow. Whatever we see is changing, losing its balance. The reason everything looks beautiful is because it is out of balance, but its background is always in perfect harmony. So it's so hard to say, give me the background, you know, keep the foreground. This is how everything exists in the realm of Buddha nature, losing its balance against the background of perfect balance. So if you see things without realizing the background of Buddha nature, everything appears to be in the form of suffering. But if you understand the background of existence, you realize that suffering itself is how we live and how we extend our life. And what I would say is it's exactly in the realization of that shifting and suffering that you see that background, that that's what gives you the background there to see as well. So in Zen, sometimes we emphasize the imbalance or disorder of life. I think probably I should stop there for now and see if anybody wants to engage any of that, or if not, we can talk about something else, and we'll do the Cohen another time.
So we're going for the background?
Well, I think we think we're not supposed to be going for the background. Though maybe we think we're going, I think I'm not supposed to be going for the background, but it's impossible not to think, not to say, oh, I'm going to pretend I'm not going for the background, but I'm going, you know, what I want is the stillness, what I want is the radiance, and I think that's fine to want, but I think there's something in there that kind of says, if I find that, I'll be safe, I'll be out of play, you know, oh yes, I don't believe in heaven anymore, so I know it's not really true, but somehow, you know, hard to imagine the self as fungible, right? It's just, you know, shredding and shredded all the time. I think that it's really hard to have an image of something that feels like a harbor, which is one of the images for sort of enlightenment, without thinking of it as therefore stable and therefore free of all the sort of roiling and destruction and rising and passing away. And what I'm suggesting is that, and maybe this is wrong, but I think that the tradition we're in is relatively unusual in suggesting that just that thing that we think we want is exactly a function of all the other stuff. You can't, and there's so much stuff in the tradition, so what happens is you have this moment of awakening and you're on top of the mountain. It's like, okay, now jump off the 100-foot pole, sort of back into the game. And that if you don't do that, it dries up on you, you lose it.
So it's elusive if it's a function of other things.
It's not elusive. It's not, the more you throw yourself into the game, the more you say, there isn't a self here that's going to be saved from this endless process, rising and falling away. The more there's nothing in reserve, the more you can see that. The more you think, now I got it, I'm going to put it in my pocket, I got what I want from Zen, you know, get out of here with the prize in my pocket, you lose it. Okay? And I think, there's this thing that happens to people in sitting where you feel like you're getting really close to something, like, so it could be like with the original face and stuff, you know, you feel, oh, here's this thing there, it's very close, and then you get this sense that this is really risky. You know, so if I see that face in the mirror that seems very old, you know, and I say, I'm going to tumble in there, you know, because I know what I want is in there. Part of what holds you back is, oh no, it's not okay to dream my own death. Do you know what I mean? That is, I know if I go for that, which is what I want, that I'm going to lose something that I'm also really trying to hang on to. I mean, this is a silly, the dream I have is wasn't profound, but I was about 13, and I know I've mentioned this before, but after my grandfather died, I saw him, and I hadn't seen, what's the Marlon Brando movie? On the Waterfront. I hadn't seen On the Waterfront, but there was this awful sort of meatpacking image in it, and so my grandfather was hung from a hook by his nightshirt in a freezer, you know, and the door was open, and he was beckoning me to come in, and, come here, you know, I love you. And I got to the threshold, and I woke up in terror, you know, because it was like, I know if I go over there, that's dying, and I can't do it. But sitting has that sort of quality to it. I know if I go toward original face, that's where I'm going, you know. And so the another talk that I was listening to, which was actually from a couple years before, and I just played it by mistake trying to find this one, Joan talks about how in the tradition, it's called the great death, you know, that moment, and then the great rebirth. And she says, you can't say much about that without sounding really schmaltzy, but she says, they ain't kidding. So there really is this sense of, there's something that you hold really, really close that it's not quite right, you have to throw it away, but in the Derrida terms, you have to put it into play. As long as you say there's this self here that's going to stand on the shore and watch all this stuff and sit in retreat and get what it wants out of retreat, you won't get it. The other thing to say, though, is the tradition insists that, and the thing about the two rooms that we keep talking about, you know, so this could be true, but the other thing could also be true. The tradition talks about it as being a nanosecond, that there's this moment, let's say, where you just let go, and then it happens, you know? And that doesn't mean that later, and I'll be trying to talk about this if I get to come back to this another time, it doesn't mean you're completely changed. You know, it's not like, oh, I threw that away, now I have no fears, now I'm not going to hold on to anything. You do it endlessly, you know? Partly, I think, because we're human and language gives us these kind of things that we think are stable, you know, because we can name them. So the tradition is constantly dumping you off the boat. Okay. You think you got it? Boom! Into the water with you now. You know? Yeah.
This idea of original faith, is that something that in meditation a person ends up pursuing or finding, and it's a positive thing, or is it just another of these fixed things that one would look for, and they're not really fixed.
Right? Yeah, it's really hard to talk about, because what I'm trying to say anyway is that there's a sense you get what you wanted, but it doesn't look like what you thought it would look like. There is this sense of, you know, there it is. Everything is stopped. Everything is perfect. Everything is brilliantly light. Everything, inside everything, there's this incredible stillness and silence. There's this sense that anything you could have wanted in some, probably not anything, you know, because I don't know. The 100 maidens will always want to go to bed with you. I don't know. but there's this thing that if there's something that you've been longing for that you wanted to be fulfilled, it's right there, you know. And at the same time, there's a sense that if you think you could peel that, and that's why I read the Derrida, you know, if you think you can peel that off of exactly what's always changing, fungible, coming into being and passing away, of completely a function of everything else, then you lose it. And the other thing that's really strange about it is if in any kind of moment of opening, I think, you feel more at home in yourself and more grounded. And that's partly the original face thing. So there I am, you know, there's Danny, right? You know. And at the same time, everything else that you're looking at is exactly like that. And you've never felt more like your existence and your personhood is completely, in that Bohm sense, sort of a function of everything else around you. Do you know what I mean? Simultaneously, and that the talks I gave a few months ago where I was trying to work with the Shitto taking part in the gathering, that sense of, you know, we and everything we perceive are interwoven and not interwoven, And this interweaving goes on and on while each thing stands in its own place. So there's simultaneously that sense of, you know, you're you, and Suzuki stresses that all the time. And at the same time, you're, I mean, it's not quite right to say you're nothing, but you're completely a function of, you know. It's a little hard to, one of the times when I was in one of these moments at a retreat, everything seemed really great, and I went into breakfast, you know, and there was an egg there and some granola, and the light was just brilliant, so they were really shining, you know. And I just started laughing, so this is really funny, I'm a thing, and I'm going to eat another thing. What a joke. You know, it was like, you know, I'm just like the egg, you know. And right now I get to eat the egg, and then later the egg will eat me or something, you know. And it was simultaneously that sense of, you know, no tanny outside of that play of stuff, and simultaneously just right there, you know. And I think you get there. I mean, stuff just happens, you know, so for no good reason. But I think you get there in some way by, and again, that's why I read the Derrida, because I think that notion of here's this thing that's sacrosanct, here's this thing that's out of play, is both so deep in our sense of ourselves and so close to what we think we're trying to find. We want to find this thing that's out of play. And the peculiarity is really, it's really, you throw that into the ring, you know, and that's what stuff arises from. And I think the tradition has various ways of trying to talk about that and sort of, I don't know, sort of make you tangle up your feet so you stumble in and fall into it by accident or something like that. Something like that.
It's even interesting to me, like the Derrida, I didn't know he was descending of rabbis, that idea of like, well, God would be this kind of like center. It's like, you know, in his own tradition, I mean, like in Kabbalah, it's like God's not static. It's like God is, you know, what was, what is, what will be is always changing. The God that was yesterday is not the God that's today, it's the God that's tomorrow. Yeah. So it's like there's not a static kind of thing there, but it's not necessarily how it's talked about, you know, congregational life, that kind of thing.
Norman talks about that from time to time, sort of in passing in his talks, that he thinks that idea of God is a misunderstanding, you know, and if you go to the right places in Jewish tradition, that's not what you find. Let me take 1 minute. I know we're out of time, but I'll just read you the koan. We won't talk about it, but we did this at a retreat with Joan a few years ago, and there's some commentary on it by various teachers that I'll read some other time. But so this is some. All right. Dasui's fire at the end of the kalpa. So the kalpa is like this incredibly long period of time, and the idea is that when a kalpa ends, the universe is destroyed, and then a new, you know, so it's very much like astrophysics or something, a new universe is born. So a student asked Dasui, "It's clear that the fire at the end of this kalpa will completely destroy the universe. I'm still not clear." As soon as you say, "I'm still not clear," you can tell somebody's trying to sneak something in. "I'm still not clear." It's, you know, you want some. "I'm still not clear whether there's something that won't be destroyed." Dasri said, "It will be destroyed." "It'll follow along with everything else?" "It will follow along with everything else," said Dasri. And then this is another part of the koan. It's not the case, but Joan is. This is quoting part. The student didn't accept Dasri's response, so he left and went to the teacher, Tuzi, to whom he recounted this conversation. Tuzi turned to his altar, lit incense, bowed to the Buddha, and said, "The ancient Buddha of Sichuan has appeared," referring to Dasri. So your teacher told you this is a Buddha, you know. Then he turned to the student and said, "You should go back there as fast as you can and make amends for your mistake." The student hurried back to Dasri, but Dasri was already dead. He returned to Tuzi, but Tuzi too had died. Swim with. I'm sorry. Swim with a little thing. This is good. This is. So Yuan Wu, when he said, "I in this term, I wonder, is this one thing destroyed or not?" says the student, and Yuan Wu says, "What is this one thing? No one on earth can get hold of this phrase." You know, so this, oh, just one little thing that won't be destroyed. And then this is a remarkable thing. Later there was a monk who asked Master of the Mountain Shui, I think it is, "The conflagration at the end of the eon, the end of the kalpa, sweeps through the universe and the universe is totally destroyed. I wonder," just one little question here. "I wonder, is this one destroyed or not?" The Master of the Mountain said, "It's not destroyed." The monk said, "Why isn't it destroyed?" The master said, "Because it's the same as the universe." That's really scary. Both it's destroyed and it's not destroyed obstruct people fatally. That's something really strange there, but so we'll talk about that another time. All right, thank you. Sorry to run over.
Yeah.